entirely. No more relying on friends and strangers and relatives. No more being passed around like a charity case. From the moment it came to his attention, Gleb had set his sights on recovering this fortune for her as if it was her salvation. And perhaps it is. Anna looks around the opulent suite where she lives by the good grace of Xenia Leeds, the damask curtains, the cherrywood floors, the gilded mirrors, Persian rugs, four-poster bed, and daydreams about what it would feel like to have a home of her own. "Dearest Anastasia," Gleb begins his letter, "I have learned for a fact that the late Emperor did have considerable sums of money in the Bank of England." Her breath catches in her throat, and she begins to read faster, her eyes landing on one stunning sentence and then another. "The Tsar deposited 5 million rubles in the Bank of England for each of his children before the Great War in 1914. I have taken the liberty to secure you an attorney by the name of Edward Fallows. It is time you had an expert on hand to protect your financial interests. Mr. Fallows has written to say that there are reliable indications that said money will be paid to the Tsar's last known legal heirs at the end of July, the 10-year anniversary of his death, if your claim to the fortune is not officially presented to the court. Please, you must contact me the moment you receive this. I've tried ringing you on the telephone, but Xenia has given instructions to her butler that I am not to speak with you. She claims it upsets you, but I suspect she is stalling, trying to ensure that we run out of time." He goes on like this for 3 pages, laying out in detail what he knows, and also his aggravation that solicitors for the Bank of England refuse to respond to his inquiry. "They say information regarding those balances can only be granted to the account holder," he writes, "and thus it is more imperative than ever that we prove your identity." Anna is pondering the significance of this news when Xenia Leeds passes beneath her open window. She is in the company of a man who is not her husband, and Anna pulls back from the window in case Xenia looks up.
"But how can you be so sure?"
Xenia's companion asks casually and in Russian. His voice echoes clearly through the courtyard. Anna knows that voice. "She has lived with me for 6 months. I've had ample opportunity to observe her," Xenia replies in Russian.
"Our family history is widely published. Anyone could fake it."
"No, not anyone. She knows things. Things only a Romanov could know." He stretches his arm by swinging his racket in a wide circle.
"Like what?"
"She knows about the Otkritie Navigitie."
"That doesn't mean anything. She could have looked it up in a book."
"Not if she doesn't speak or read Russian like they claim. Besides, a detail like that means quite a bit to a Romanov. The opening of navigation is tradition. Don't you remember?" she asks.
"Of course I do."
"Then you cannot discount a detail like that. Any daughter of the Tsar would remember the commandant of St. Petersburg bringing that glass of water after the final thaw. It was the beginning of trade each year. I drank from that cup twice myself as a child. I know you did too, Dmitri."
"It is only one thing, Xenia, and it does not convince me. It won't convince our aunts either."
"Dmitri Leuchtenberg." "No, it can't be. Not that hateful, conniving bastard." So Xenia has broken her promise not to involve the family. Anna can feel her rage begin to boil. She glares at the two figures below. "It's not just that," Xenia continues. "There are dozens of other things, small things, only Anastasia would remember. But please, it can wait. William needs to be part of this discussion. He's in the study working, but we'll be ready in an hour. For now, let's play. You promise to let me win at least one game." They walk away, their voices swallowed by distance. The farther they get from the house, the more relaxed Xenia appears, and then they step through the gate and onto the courts. Anna does not leave her chair for that entire hour. She stays seated, back straight, feet crossed at the ankles, Gleb's letter resting on her lap. Occasionally she can hear the deep whack of the racket as it connects with the ball, and every once in a while a bit of laughter or a word in Russian reaches her ears, but the conversation itself is entirely lost. Xenia and Dmitri emerge some time later, red-faced and laughing. Whatever tension was present before is gone now, and Anna can tell by the look on Xenia's face that she prevailed on the courts. The look on Dmitri's face suggests that she did so by her own skill, and not because of any gentlemanly gesture on his part. The moment they pass beneath her window again, Anna leaves her suite and makes her way to the study on the first floor. It is easy to get lost in the house at Oyster Bay. Even after 6 months, Anna finds herself turned around in the hallways and often mistakes one room for another. 4 sets of stairs, at least a dozen different hallways, endless doors. So although she hurries, it takes her several minutes to find the study, and by then the door is already closed, its occupants safely tucked inside. "Damn it all!" Anna hisses and retreats several feet down the hall to stand behind an enormous potted fern that is nearly as tall as she is. She needs a moment to think. She needs to know what they're saying. If the windows to the study were open, she could risk going outside and sitting beneath them. But she would likely be discovered. If not by William himself, she's seen him sitting on the window ledge more than once smoking his pipe. Then certainly by the gardener, a man who tends the bushes by the house with nothing short of religious zeal. She is lamenting her lost opportunity when the maid approaches from the other direction, balancing a silver tray laden with lemonade. Anna has seen the girl on multiple occasions. She's neither pretty nor smart, but she is dutiful and efficient and never gets in the way. But her hands are full at the moment, and she cannot open the study door. So she taps at it quietly with one foot, and it is opened from within. She emerges a few minutes later, carrying the same tray, now loaded down with an empty coffee service. Even from this distance, Anna can see the consternation on the girl's face. Unable to shut the door with her hands full, she pulls it toward her with the toe of one shoe, then walks away, leaving a crack some 3 inches wide. The moment she's gone, Anna creeps back down the hallway and stands outside the study door, a lucky break. "What game are you playing, Xenia?" William's voice is neither a whisper nor a growl, but some other menacing sound that stops Anna short. Xenia's answer, when it comes, sounds more bored than defensive. "Tennis, darling. Isn't it obvious?" "That's not what I mean, and you know it." She hears the thump of something heavy being set on wood, and guesses that William Leeds is done with his lemonade. "First you bring that strange woman into our home. How else was I supposed to determine her true identity?" "And have you?"
"I believe so, yes."
"And now this man," William finishes. Dmitri speaks in English with a heavy Russian accent.
"I invited myself. Multiple times, in fact. Your wife was reluctant to see me."
William's voice is dry.
"I can't imagine why."
"He has brought an offer," Xenia says, "from the family." William curses loudly and without apology to their guest.
"The family. Of course, I should have known. Of all the families on God's green earth to marry into, I go and choose the Romanovs. I ought to be damned for my stupidity." He sighs. "What do they want?"
"To make your guest an offer," Dmitri answers.
"What sort?"
"The sort that will make everyone happy."
"Why do I have the feeling it is designed to keep her quiet and to shut her out?" William asks.
Dmitri clears his throat and speaks to Xenia.
"I fear you have been duped, cousin. Unforgivable, considering how much is at stake. A motivated impostor could learn many things about our family."
"I do not believe she is an impostor."
"What of Ekaterinburg? Does she speak of that? Does she have an explanation?"
"She will not talk of the murders, and I cannot blame her."
Dmitri snorts.
"Have you pressed her?"
"Of course not."
"You should. It would be very telling," he says. "What of her escape?"
"Only that it was a long, long journey, and that she remained unconscious for most of it.
Convenient. It prevents her from giving geographical details. It also prevents us from finding witnesses.
You are a terrible cynic.
This woman poses a great threat to us. It is my duty to be cynical. I'm surprised you haven't embraced your own duties.
It would be nice if she started with her own immediate family, William says, and cared less for the one abroad.
You knew what you were getting when you married me. As I recall, you liked it at the time, Xenia snaps, and then to Dmitri. I embrace the truth, nothing less.
Anna wishes she could see their faces and read their body language. Words are important, but they only tell part of the story. It's impossible to know their full meaning without seeing how they glance at one another, pull at their sleeves, or hold the glass in their hands. 1,000 truths are written across the body during any given conversation, and they often say more than the words spoken aloud.
You exaggerate your nobility, Xenia, Dmitri says. This is a game to you, and you want to win. Though I don't agree with the others that it's the money you're after. You seem to have enough of that.
Anna can hear the dangerous note in Xenia's voice.
They think I'm after the money. Not all of them, just our aunts. It's a considerable amount, after all.
There is no proof the funds even exist.
I am told the accounts are not in the Tsar's name, but in his children's, and only the account holder can request a receipt, or, he pauses for effect, a recognized claimant.
William Leeds sounds truly interested for the first time. Money is a language he understands very well.
Recognized meaning, the courts would have to officially declare her to be Anastasia Romanov before she could even request a balance, much less have access to any funds.
But the family
receives everything in the absence of a more direct next of kin. Bloody ruthless bastards, William says with a note of appreciation.
Anna takes a step back and leans against the wall, her ear near the hinges, still listening, but now pondering her situation as well. So Gleb was right about everything. No wonder he's been so frantic to get in touch with her. Dmitri sips loudly from his glass.
So you can see why the family is loath to declare her, why any action must be taken with the utmost care, and only in the face of undeniable evidence. It is unthinkable that such a fortune be placed in the hands of a fraud.
And they think I am being swayed in her favor? Xenia pauses briefly, and then her voice goes flat in disbelief.
You are here to ask that I expel her from my home.
Dmitri doesn't deny it.
They fear she has a strong hold on you, that you are beginning to take her part. They sent me simply to express their concern.
They sent you to get rid of her?
No, he says vehemently. They sent me to interrogate her, to help them make a case should this end up in court.
I will not allow it, not in my home. Xenia shakes her head, and I cannot believe this is coming up again. I know what they're getting at, but I am certain she is not that Polish peasant our aunts claimed that she is.
Be careful with that assertion, Xenia, and for God's sake, don't let that get into the papers. The family is getting ready to make a public statement about the Schanskowskas. We must keep a united front.
It is at these words that Anna stiffens. She had hoped that the name Schanskowska would never be uttered in her hearing again. She thought the matter was taken care of, but apparently this is one issue she cannot put to rest. The Romanov descendants have an unshakable grip on that name, and now the accusations are surfacing again, but she will not be caught off guard this time. There is a single telephone in the house. It's on the first floor, in the main entrance, and is zealously guarded by the Leeds's butler, a man so ill-humoured and dour-faced he could put any imperial servant to shame. Anna breezes past him in the foyer and raises one hand as if warding off an evil spirit. She lifts the receiver without asking permission and dials Gleb's home number. When he finally answers, he's out of breath and sounds as though he has just run up a flight of stairs.
"Botkin residence. Gleb speaking," he gasps.
I need you to come get me, Anna says without so much as a hello.
Thank God. You got my letter. I've been trying desperately to reach...
Xenia has broken her promise, Anna interrupts. She's led Dimitri onto the property to interview me.
He curses loudly and then says, I thought we were rid of him.
Oh, no. He's back and has already brought up this Hanskovska affair. He says the family is preparing to make a statement.
Go pack your bags, Gleb says without a pause. Immediately. I will be there before nightfall.
The shouting match is extraordinary. Gleb and Xenia have been at it for nearly half an hour. Anna has remained silent the entire time. She's perched at the edge of a divan, hands folded in her lap, face expressionless. William Leeds sits on the window ledge behind his wife, ready to step in the moment things get out of control. Gleb and Xenia stand toe to toe in the middle of the study, like two boxers getting ready to tap gloves. All of this is witnessed by a third man, who looks uncomfortable at best and at moments stricken by terror. His name is Edward Fallows, and he is apparently Anna's attorney. But they've not even had the chance to shake hands or greet each other properly, because the screaming began the moment Gleb marched up the front steps and into the foyer. The butler at least had the good sense to herd them into the study and away from the eager ears of the staff. If Dimitri is still on the grounds, he has long since made himself scarce. It's the only intelligent thing the man has done all day.
I cannot believe you brought a lawyer onto my property, Xenia growls between clenched teeth.
I cannot believe you broke your promise. You swore not to trap her the way they did at Wasserberg.
Dimitri is my cousin. I have the right to visit with him if I choose.
You should have done it elsewhere.
It would appear that William Leeds is actually enjoying the altercation. He smiles and draws on the lit pipe in his hand. He's been puffing at the thing for the last 30 minutes, from the moment his wife called Gleb a disgrace to all Russians.
I believe this estate is ours, William says, and we're rather entitled to entertain whoever we like.
Gleb glares at him but doesn't respond. His fight is with Xenia alone.
Why was Dimitri here? The truth.
He was sent by the family.
For what purpose?
To interview her. Something. Xenia raises one long, elegant finger and points it at Gleb's nose. I obviously didn't allow.
Only because Anna got wind of it first. Tell me about his offer.
It is an olive branch.
How so?
This is a very complex matter for my family, Xenia says. One with many moving parts. But they are aware of Anna's suffering and do not want to inflict more upon her. They are not as indifferent as they appear.
They appear cruel, Gleb interjects.
Let me finish, please. You barged in here and forced my hand. At least have the courtesy to hear me out.
Gleb snorts.
Hear you. I get the distinct impression that I am, in fact, listening to the Tsar's sisters right now.
You are listening to us, the family as a whole. We have a proposition, a compromise, if you will.
Oh, so now it's the royal we. This ought to be good.
It is better than good. It is generous. Gracious, even.
Xenia turns from Gleb and crosses the room to sit beside Anna on the divan. She takes both of her hands and squeezes them reassuringly.
I am sorry about today. I never meant to betray your trust. I am your friend. You have to believe that.
Anna says nothing, allowing Xenia to feel the full weight of her embarrassment.
Your offer,
Gleb prompts.
The Tsar's sisters are prepared to support you financially for the rest of your life.
In exchange for what?
Anna asks. They're the first words she's uttered directly to Xenia since this afternoon.
They will find you a secluded spot in Europe, Xenia says, avoiding the question. A place of your choosing, perhaps Crimea. I know how much you love it there. Or the south of France. Tuscany, if you like. Bavaria. Switzerland. Maybe a lovely chalet in the mountains. You will have enough to buy a home, keep a handful of servants. Live comfortably and in peace for the rest of your days. A home of your own. I know that's what you desire.
It sounds too good to be true.
There must be strings attached. Anna is sure of it.
And what exactly must I give in exchange for such a privilege?
The sound that Xenia makes is not so much a sigh or a groan, but a sort of gasp. The kind of noise you make when you know you're about to be struck across the face. A preemptive admission of guilt. To Anna's credit, she keeps her hands limp inside Xenia's firm grasp. Anna does not flinch, much less strike her when the answer finally comes.
All that the family asks in return is that you renounce all claim to the name and title of Anastasia Romanov.
Oh! Gleb screams with such ferocity that William Leeds finally takes a step forward in concern. Is that all? How fucking generous of them!
The profanity falls like a glass bowl, shattering the room into silence. Xenia is aghast, her royal sensibilities more offended by the word than by the degrading offer she's just made.
Gleb, for his part, is choking on his anger and cannot summon another word. William Leeds is giddy with the entertainment of it all. Anna half expects him to roll up his shirt sleeves and exclaim that he hasn't had this much fun in months. Edward Fallows, however, has the look of a wolf sniffing blood. He's leaning forward in his chair, fingers steepled, brow furrowed, bouncing on the balls of his feet. Anna's voice is dry and quiet when she finally responds.
They want to buy me off, to sweep me away like a bit of unwanted rubbish.
No, Xenia shakes her head. On the contrary, they want to protect you, and themselves. This is the easiest way.
The easiest way for them,
Gleb says, finally mastering his power of speech.
Don't you start, Xenia hisses. You're the one who brought a lawyer into this. And they're the ones who went to the papers with word of the inheritance. How were we supposed to respond? Ignore the fact that her father left her a fortune? Let it be taken by someone else? They meant to smear her name with that announcement, to say she's only claiming to be Anastasia to collect the fortune, and now they mean to strip her of her title as well.
They are prepared to take financial responsibility for her.
And now Xenia pulls out her trump card and plays it with aplomb. She turns those eager, hopeful eyes on Anna and swallows her in their dark depths.
If you accept, I will take you to Copenhagen to see the Dowager Empress.
Even Gleb is surprised to hear this. The Dowager Empress has refused to meet with Anna at every turn, never so much as responding to a single letter or public plea. Her acknowledgement is the one thing Anna needs to end her quest, a thing so far beyond her grasp that she can only hope for it. It would only take a word from the Tsar's mother, and she would once again have the right to her own name.
She asked to see me?
Anna cringes at the undisguised hope in her voice, trembling and desperate. A long pause.
No, but she has agreed to it at least. I am certain she will, if only...
Anna jerks her hands away from Xenia.
She doesn't even know. I can get a meeting with her, I promise. Like you promised to keep the other Romanovs away. Like you promised not to ambush me.
Edward Fallows speaks for the first time. His voice is deep and rich and calm, not the voice Anna expects from such a timid-looking man.
I am loath to interrupt here, given the fact that my presence is not exactly welcome. But as Anna's legal representative, I am obligated to ask if any part of this offer has been put in writing. Is there a document my client can study or amend?
Not yet.
Xenia stiffens at this interruption.
Dmitri only brought word of the offer today, but I am certain papers can be drawn up immediately.
Again, we are asked to rely on your word alone, Gleb says.
Here William Leeds claps one giant hand onto Gleb's shoulder. Take all the shots you like at her family.
Hell, it's no secret they're all a bunch of spoiled tyrants, but I'll not have you insult my wife.
Gleb shakes the hand away.
Your wife is a Romanov.
Xenia Leeds finally snaps at the intended insult.
And you will very much regret meddling in the affairs of the House of Romanov. I regret only that I have allowed a tawdry bribe to be dangled in front of the Tsar's rightful heir. And for what? A pittance.
Do not make this about money. It should be about her welfare. Gleb growls.
Easy for you to say. You have all the money you'll ever need. She, on the other hand, lives in constant fear of being cast into the streets.
She will have all the money she needs if she simply accepts the offer.
But not as much as your aunt's. What they are offering her is a fraction of the interest that fortune earns each year. They will send her quietly away and then fill their own coffers to the point of overflowing. And yours as well, no doubt. That's the real reason you've kept her locked away all summer. You needed the statute of limitations to expire. 10 years to the day since the Tsar's death, I believe. The time is up this month.
He spits out the next words, as though they are a mouthful of poison.
How close you came to stealing a fortune, Xenia.
Only Gleb can say too much and ruin everything. He has always been like this. Loyal to a fault. Protective. Zealous in his devotion to Anna. And she loves him for it. She really does. Even when he goes too far. Even when he knocks down the whole damn house of cards. Because there is no one else who cares this much about her.
Xenia jumps to her feet in outrage, and William sets his pipe on the desk, his eyes locked on Gleb as he begins to roll up his shirt sleeves. Anna is certain things will dissolve into madness, that punches will be thrown and lines crossed if she does not intervene. So she rises to her feet and asks a question. It goes unanswered in the cacophony. Edward Fallows, good man that he is, comes to her aid by letting loose a deafening whistle. The sort one would need if hailing a cab in the middle of Armageddon.
The lady just asked a question,
he roars when all eyes turn to him. The room falls silent, and Anna clears her throat.
And what will happen if I do not agree to this offer?
Then I am afraid I will have to ask you to leave Oyster Bay within 48 hours. I have been told in no uncertain terms that if I am to remain in the good graces of my family, I can no longer be your host.
Anna has loved her time at Kenwood. Her walks through the woods collecting mushrooms and pine cones. Her time on the beach with her feet in the cold, clear water. She keeps a jar of smooth stones she found on the shore, all pink and grey and cream. They look like the Jordan almonds she used to eat as a child. Anna loves the horseback riding and solitude and her little suite of rooms. This place has been a good home for her. But she will not beggar herself in order to keep it.
I am very sorry to hear that, Anna says, finally, and rises to her feet.
She offers Xenia and then her husband a noble nod.
And now, if you'll excuse me, I need to go pack my things.
Chapter 18. Anastasia. A Changing of the Guard. 1918. Tobolsk, Russia. February 1918. The first thing Yakov Yurovsky does upon taking command of the governor's house is send most of our guards away and replace them with members of the Red Guard, the Bolsheviks' hastily formed military. In the end, 200 of the 350 soldiers who came with us from Tsarskoye Selo are dismissed to fronts and futures unknown. We watch them go more and more every day, our unease growing as every wagonful of men departs. Each day I wait for Thomas to be among those dispatched from the governor's house, wondering if he'll be allowed to say goodbye, or if he will simply disappear from my life altogether. Yakov gave the order to replace our guards, but Leshy is required to carry it out. He spends the first few days at the barracks nearby, giving soldiers their notice one by one, and comes back to the house each night, smelling of cigar smoke and looking guilt-ridden, as though he has murdered a puppy. Thomas grew distant the moment Yakov arrived. He no longer speaks to me, or acknowledges me when we pass in the hallways or in the yard. There is no more flirting. The glancing touches and warm comments cease. I do find him staring at me sometimes when he thinks Yakov won't notice, but he looks away or leaves the room whenever I make eye contact. At one time, Thomas's presence could be guaranteed the moment I stepped into the yard, but now strangers accompany me as I do my chores, barking at me that I should not get too close to the wall, and that I must work faster. Sometimes I find Thomas watching me from one of the upstairs windows, but I dare not wave or smile. He looks sad, as though he's lost something important, and I always turn away before the strict new guards notice my gaze. The second thing Yakov does is increase the number of guards stationed inside the house. Prior to his arrival, there were 20 men living upstairs. They watched and protected us, but never interfered with our daily lives. Yakov adds 30 to that number, and we feel the strain immediately. The house grows crowded and loud, and there are eyes on us constantly. Our world shrinks again, like a belt being tightened 2 notches. We can still breathe, but our movements become constricted and uncomfortable. It is alarming how quickly Semyon finds favor with Yakov. He is promoted again and placed in charge of the governor's house. He hovers near us, taking every opportunity to criticize and humiliate us. He kicks the dogs and spits indoors. Our only defense is to ignore him, to rise above his vile insults. At the end of the first week, Leshy calls us into Father's study. He taps his thigh with the edge of a folded telegram while we take our seats. All that dark hair is wild, as though he's been tugging at it all day.
"Vladimir Lenin," he says without preamble, "is no longer willing to pay for your living expenses."
"That is unacceptable," Father jumps to his feet. "You cannot keep us in exile and then leave us to starve."
"He is no longer willing," Leshy says again slowly, "to pay for your living expenses beyond 600 rubles a month per person. That includes your family only."
"What of our staff? We can't support them on..."
Mother counts off the total on her fingers.
"Just over 4,000 rubles a month."
"Yakov suggested all of your staff be lined up outside and shot dead. But I convinced him that it would be better to let them live."
"He wouldn't," Mother whispers, aghast.
I think of Botkin and Dover, Gilliard, Troop, and Cook lying dead in the yard, and I begin to understand the reality of our situation. I want to throw up. I want to cry and run from the room, but I force myself to focus on what Leshy is saying.
"He would. He wants to, in fact. You may have noticed that since Yakov's arrival, I hold little power in this garrison. But I have persuaded him that 5 slaughtered servants will create a problem he is not equipped to deal with. Take the opportunity while you have it. Make do with your new allowance."
Mother's voice trembles.
"We cannot make this work. It is cruel."
"Not so cruel as a firing squad. You must make do, for their sake."
"I am afraid that you have run up considerable credit with many of the merchants in Tobolsk,"
Pierre Gilliard says later that evening. He spreads the accounts on the table, pointing at one sum and then another.
"They must be paid, and quickly, lest you make even more enemies."
"How?"
Mother's voice is constricted with emotion. She pauses, clearing her throat.
"There is no room in our allowance."
"You must find a way. Pull something from what you've set aside. You cannot afford to make enemies in town. There may come a point when you need their help."
Poor Gilliard. I have underestimated the man terribly. I have mistaken commitment for cruelty. I want to tell him that I am sorry, that I am ashamed. But all his attention is turned toward Mother. In the end, she does as he suggests, sending Gilliard off with a purse full of money to pay the accounts. The fact that 12 people remain in the house, while only 7 of us are granted a stipend, is a problem we're expected to solve without complaint. Whatever my parents suspect might lie in store for us is a thing they do not share. But I notice that Father and Gilliard continue to pore over maps at night. They continue to whisper among themselves.
This is a ration card,
Yakov Yurovsky says the next morning. He drops it into father's lap. I flinch, startled as always at the cannon-like sound of his voice.
Like all other citizens in this country, you are entitled to a basic food allowance.
Leshy stands at the door to the study, his face expressionless and his hands folded before him. That red kerchief hangs from his pocket like a warning flag. This is the posture he assumes whenever Yakov is near, detachment. It's the same attitude shown by Thomas and Ivan in Yakov's presence, and I hope it's only a facade, a way of feigning disinterest in order to protect us. Father lifts the small rectangular green piece of cardboard from his lap. His voice is terse as he recites the specifics printed before him.
Nicholas Romanov, ex-emperor of Freedom Street.
He glares at this description, but continues.
6 dependents, ration card number 54, good for flour, butter, and sugar.
Mother peers at the card. What of coffee? We ran out last week.
That, Yakov says, is a luxury unavailable to the general populace.
Mother rubs her temples. She has, for as long as I've been aware, relied on coffee for comfort and sanity, the way father relies on physical exercise. In the days since our supply dwindled and then disappeared entirely, she has suffered from one long, unending headache. Mother insists that it is concentrated entirely in her right temple, and as a result, that eye has watered for 3 days straight.
I will manage,
she whispers, brushing the pad of one thumb across her wet eyelashes. It is the first time I pity my mother, the first time I see her as completely human, a woman who can be broken by something as simple as a headache. It is an unsettling realization, and I wonder if she, with all her age and experience, can be broken in such a way. What will become of me? 3 weeks later. Tobolsk, Russia. March 15th, 1918. Gleb and Tanya Botkin are sent away at first thaw. They stand on the boardwalk outside the house, suitcases in hand, staring at the schoolroom as though watching a funeral procession. We do our best to cheer them, waving and smiling, but they turn away, despondent. This is twice now that Botkin has dismissed them, Maria says over my shoulder. Gleb is tired of being treated like a child. He is a child. She jabs me in the ribs with her elbow, and I yelp. Takes one to know one. I'm about to argue, but she interrupts me. Has your menses started? Maria correctly interprets my silence. She grins in triumph. Like I said, a child.
You don't have to be such a donkey about it, I hiss.
Ass. The word is ass. If you're going to insult me, do it properly. I might not be bleeding like a stuck pig every month the way you are, but at least my ass is not the size of a donkey's. I'm out the door before she can think of a suitable retort, but I notice how she slides her hands along the back of her skirt. It's a subconscious movement, a show of insecurity, and it proves to me that the insult hit home. I know it's cruel, and I should apologize, but I don't have time to stroke my sister's vanity today. Dr. Botkin will be leaving any minute to escort Gleb and Tanya to the steamship waiting at the dock, and there's something I have to find before they leave. The photo album is at the bottom of a small wooden chest that rests at the foot of my camp bed. It is small and square with a brown leather cover, but they will recognize its significance. The little album is filled with pictures of my family, our trips and images of daily life at the Alexander Palace, and sprinkled throughout the pages are pictures of our friends and servants, Gleb and Tanya among them. I brought it on a whim and haven't opened it once since our arrival. But I know my friends, so glum and disappointed, will love the memento. I catch Botkin as he's walking out the door. Wait for me, I shout.
You can't come with me, Schwibzik.
I know. I want to say goodbye. Semyon and Thomas straddle the door, and Botkin looks to them for approval.
Let her go to the gate. It won't hurt anything. What is that?
Semyon asks, looking at my hands. Only a photo album. I flip it open to show him there's nothing hidden inside. A farewell gift. He stares at it for a moment, thinking, then shakes his head.
No. Outside contact is forbidden.
That's not fair.
Argue again and I'll confiscate it.
Botkin grips my shoulder with his huge, warm hand and squeezes just enough to make his warning clear. He kneels before me and pries the album from my hands. None of this is fair, Shripsik. None of it. But I will give this to the children for you, and they will treasure it always. In the 7 months they've been in Tobolsk, I've been allowed to visit with Gleb and Tanya only once, during our trip to church on Christmas Eve. Yet their dismissal hits me harder than I expect. It seems an arbitrary cruelty. Tell them I'm sorry that I couldn't see them more often. I wanted to.
They know. And they would do anything for you, Anastasia. Gleb in particular. I fear my boy is besotted with you.
Botkin brushes a tear from my cheek with one knuckle, and I look up in time to see a curious expression sweep across Thomas's face. Pity? Jealousy? Maybe anger. I can't identify it. He remains still, keeping his post without argument or emotion. Tell them goodbye, I say, swallowing the lump in my throat. Tell them not to forget me. He pulls me tight against his chest.
Fear not, Shripsik. You are not the sort of girl one forgets.
1 week later. Tobolsk, Russia, March 21st, 1918. We are surprised by an early spring. Winter sweeps out in the same sudden rush in which it arrived. Within 3 days, the only snow left in the entire town is Alexei's mountain in the yard, now a pitiful, dirty pile of slush. He takes the loss of his favorite plaything like a personal insult. I find him one afternoon trying to mount the hill with his garbage-lid sled, only to end up knee-deep in melting snow, his trousers and shoes soaked, his mood foul. "Where are you going?" I shout after him as he turns and trudges toward the house, gripping that sled as though he is off to battle. My brother has always been a docile, quiet boy, so I am startled to see the look of pure rage and determination on his face.
"Sledding!"
he shouts, pushing through the back door of the house.
"They can't take everything away from me. They can't."
"No one took anything from you, Alexei. The snow melted," I yell, picking up the hem of my skirt and trudging after him through the mud. But he goes through the kitchen door as if he hasn't heard me. Curious and a little alarmed, I follow him into the house, making it just in time to hear Mother shout, "Don't you do that, Alexei. No! Stop it right now!" And then there is a thunderous clatter of metal on wood, and I step around the corner in time to see my brother hurtling down the stairs. For one moment, there is a look of profound joy on his face, the look he used to get when we pulled him in the wagon as a toddler, or the look he got while sitting atop the elephant's back at Alexander Palace. It is an expression of wild abandonment, of little boyhood, and adventure. It is euphoric. But it turns to terror in the time it takes me to blink, because the edge of his stupid, ridiculous, murderous garbage lid catches the lip of the next step and flips so quickly he's flung into the air, arms and legs flailing wildly. It happens the way all terrible accidents happen. In slow motion. Time suspended. Your body frozen. Your mind racing. Alexei lands, legs split at an unnatural angle near the bottom of the stairs. And then he slides the last few steps, thumping to a stop near Mother's feet. I can see the scream building in his chest as he gasps silently, searching for breath. And then the sound breaks free, shattering the air. Surprise and pain and fear. In the time it takes me to cross those last few steps to where he lies, Alexei thrashes on the floor, shrieking and clutching his groin as though he's been cleaved in half. Mother is frozen, horrified and silent. Reaching him first, I scoop Alexei up and drop onto the bottom step. I draw him onto my lap and can feel him shudder. My ears ring with his wailing. He writhes in my arms, but I clamp him tighter against my body, knowing that he has to calm himself and be still. I can feel the warmth of his blood pooling where he sits on my lap. I can feel it, but I refuse to look. I won't look. I can't look. Because when Alexei starts to bleed, he doesn't stop.
Chapter 19. Anna. Oyster Bay. 1928. The pier at East 13th Street, New York City. February 9th. Gleb allows the driver to make one stop as they leave Manhattan, a newsstand on the corner of 19th Street and 8th Avenue. He quickly buys a copy of every newspaper available, then rushes back to the car. Look! He lifts a copy of the Herald Tribune and points to the headline. Lost daughter of the Tsar hides on ship in bay. Another reads, Legendary Duchess lands. The New York Times, the New York Post, the New York World, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Herald Tribune, the Gotham Gazette, and half a dozen other papers all cover the story, each of them taking a different angle on her arrival and identity. Gleb is positively giddy. Don't you see, Anna? We're winning. I didn't realize we were competing. Of course we are. Good grief, woman, did you just get here? He laughs at his own joke because, yes, she did, in fact, arrive only hours ago. You aren't making any sense. Competing with whom? The family, the Romanov cousins, and those two wicked aunts of yours. She hasn't made the connection between today's headlines and her ongoing feud with the Dowager Empress and the Tsar's sisters. There are other battles raging, of course, small fires that keep erupting all over Europe every time a distant relation learns of her claim, but none burn so bright as those involving the immediate family. Anna shakes her head. I don't see victory, I see chaos. No, no, it's the perception. Everything is about perception right now. People are truly beginning to believe that you are Anastasia, he says, lifting the Herald Tribune and reading part of an editorial aloud. She comes surrounded like the exploits of Colonel T.E. Lawrence, with the full publicity of a complete reticence. He runs a finger along the page until he finds the line he's looking for. Yes, here it is. She granted no interviews, but locked herself in her cabin, preserving an impenetrable manner that divided between regal hauteur and utter indifference to openly expressed skepticism. That makes me sound impossible. It makes you sound imperious, he grins. A good thing. It took 1 week for Anna to make the journey from Castle Zeon to New York. Her passage was paid for in equal parts by Xenia Leeds, the Tsar's niece several times removed, and Sergei Rachmaninoff, the famed Russian composer. Exactly how he'd gotten involved she doesn't know, but she's grateful for the escape regardless. Anna wasted no time leaving Germany and had ceremonially wiped the dust from her feet. She boarded the steamship Berengaria, with a passport and visa under the assumed last name of Anderson, a necessary concession since the passport office would not issue one to her as Anastasia Romanov. So she is now Anna Anderson. It will take some getting used to. 7 days at sea prove that she has no stomach for travelling by boat. Anna spent the majority of her time in the stateroom, practising her English, and praying to the porcelain throne in her private lavatory. Ich habe Angst, she muttered over and over in her worst moments, lying cradled on the floor with her arms wrapped around her stomach like a child. I am afraid. Afraid the seasickness would kill her, and sometimes, in the throes of a wild bout of nausea, wishing that it would. Afraid this journey would be in vain. But she survived the trip, and when they finally reached New York Harbor, they could not dock and were forced to wait in the bay until the heavy, soup-like fog lifted. And then, this morning, they were met with an entire press corps that had camped out all night on the dock. They shouted questions and shoved cameras in her face and pressed against her as Gleb guided her to the car. "Show us your face," they shouted. Who are you really? They asked. Have you come to break into the film business? Are you here for an arranged marriage? Will you stay? Will you live in Manhattan?
Tell them, Anna whispered into Gleb's ear as he shoved her into the back seat of the waiting car, that I will give no interviews. Not today, not tomorrow, not ever. Dutiful as ever, Gleb obeyed. And finally her heart has stilled its frantic pace as they maneuver their way out of Manhattan and onto her next great adventure. Oyster Bay is a community of summer homes and tennis whites, manicured lawns and garden parties, yachts and country clubs. The closer they get to the home of Xenia Leeds, the lower Anna sinks into her seat. What's the matter with you?
What if she doesn't acknowledge me? What if this is a waste of time?
She invited you. She wants you here.
She is one of them.
She is your only option at the moment. The drive from Manhattan to Oyster Bay takes an hour and a half, and despite her nerves, Anna finally does relax. The Long Island Sound stays in view for much of the drive, and she keeps her gaze on the choppy, steel-colored water and the vessels that traverse back and forth, ferries, yachts, tugboats, and great long trawlers piled high with garbage and steel beams. They pass over bridges and through tree-covered lanes. Soon she has lost interest in the sound and has turned her gaze to the sprawling brick homes that line the road. It doesn't take long to figure out that the more elaborate the mailbox, the more stately the home. After a while, the estates are set so far back from the road that she can see nothing but rock walls, hedges, and wrought iron fences. After a while, they slow to take a bend in the road, and a long white fence, anchored by brick columns, comes into view. But unlike the other fences she's seen so far, this one stretches for nearly a quarter of a mile. And then they slow even more and turn into a driveway of crushed gravel. Anna has to crane her neck to see the top of the gate as they pass through.
This is it? She asks, stunned.
Not what you expected.
I didn't realize it would be so large.
Gleb laughs. The first thing you need to know about William Leeds is that he does not do things on a small scale. He's the son and heir of a tin magnate. They say that God owns the cattle on 1,000 hills, but William Leeds leases him the farmland. Think about it. He rolls down the window so she can smell the sharp, clean scent of freshly raked pine needles. The man went and found himself a bona fide Russian princess for a wife.
When they pull into the circular driveway, there is a full entourage waiting for them. Both William and Xenia Leeds, along with much of the household staff. It is nothing short of a royal reception, complete with curtsies, bows, and a bouquet of bright, fragrant winter jasmine. Gleb helps Anna from the car, and they present themselves before the family. If there is a prettier, more fashionable woman anywhere in the world, Anna has never met her, and she suddenly regrets her juvenile choice of an entirely white wardrobe in Paris the day before they set sail, because Xenia Leeds, in less than 30 seconds, has shown her how to make dove grey look transcendent in the dead of winter.
I am so delighted you agreed to come, Xenia says in English, but her Russian accent is strong. It is a pleasure to see you again.
Anna dips her head, just enough to acknowledge a peer, but not so much as to show deference.
The pleasure is all mine. Thank you for having me.
Please, Xenia says, meet my husband, William. It should be a crime for any two people to be so attractive. Anna is a bit unnerved to see that William Leeds is almost prettier than his wife. Anna feels suddenly shabby and laughable. She drops her eyes, pulls at the cuffs of her simple wool dress.
Call me Billy. He says, William is such a stuffy name.
One that I insist on using despite his arguments, Xenia says with just the slightest hint of disapproval. It's there in the twitch of her nose, something akin to a sniff.
Anna guesses that Xenia prefers the stuffy name, so she says, Then I shall do the same. She motions Gleb to step forward,
and it is only then that she realizes Xenia is stubbornly refusing to acknowledge his presence. William, for his part, looks at Gleb with pity.
And, of course, you know Gleb Botkin. Of course, but I am afraid he is not welcome at Kenwood. Not today or any other day.
She says this in the driest, most disinterested tone, as if Anna had suggested they take in a stray cat. Gleb stands there, mouth opening and closing like a dying fish, as he tries to find an acceptable reply. Anna speaks instead.
I don't understand.
Xenia turns her dark, obsidian eyes on Gleb. We agreed that there would be no press. She nods to the butler, who dutifully unfolds a copy of the New York Times, with a bold headline proclaiming Anna's arrival.
Yes, but we need it.
I'm afraid you have complicated things for me immensely.
I meant no harm. I only wanted...
Xenia sighs, and the sound is filled with 300 years' worth of exasperated monarchs.
What you wanted is irrelevant, given the circus that is about to descend upon my doorstep.
No, he insists. I told the press we were going elsewhere. No reporters will show up here.
It's not the press I'm worried about, Xenia says.
Anna has gone from feeling elation to the confusion that happens immediately prior to a betrayal. She does not realize that she is backing up until she bumps into the car.
Please, Xenia says, we mean you no harm. Our invitation stands. Your room is ready. And we are delighted to have you as a guest. But if he wishes to remain in Oyster Bay, he must find other accommodations. He cannot stay here. Not now.
I don't understand why the news of her arrival is so upsetting.
Xenia lifts the newspaper from between the butler's gloved, pinched fingers and hands it to Gleb. She points at a paragraph below the fold.
It's not the arrival, it's the accusation.
He reads for several seconds, eyes growing larger with each word.
But I didn't give this statement. I know nothing about it.
Of course you didn't. It was wired to the Times by a spokesman for my family, my cousin Dimitri.
Dimitri Lochtenberg? Anna asks.
Xenia frowns.
Yes, but how... I was staying with his family prior to leaving Germany.
What, Anna asks, desperately trying to keep the anger from her voice, does that article say? Gleb pokes the newspaper with a single finger.
This article accuses us of masterminding a conspiracy to wrest control of funds that the Tsar's sisters are trying to claim.
Anna's irritation is growing by the second.
What funds are they talking about?
Gleb looks at her, almost apologetically.
Your father's. The long-rumored missing fortune of Tsar Nicholas II. Untold millions, held in trust at the Bank of England for his heirs.
He turns on Xenia.
So it's true, then. The money does exist. Your family has denied it for years.
My family is complicated, and that is why you cannot disrupt the situation further with your presence. They will hear of it, and whatever progress has been made with your cause will be lost.
Anna pulls the newspaper from Gleb's hands and reads the article for herself.
Why didn't you say anything about this in the car? You bought all the papers.
Two bright circles appear on his cheeks.
I admit that I only skimmed the articles. I did not read below the fold on most.
She would smack him across the head with this paper if she thought it would help. But Gleb's mouth pulls in at the corners and his eyes close to slits. It's the face he gets when he's thinking furiously. And she knows that he is formulating some new plan, something that will help them adapt to this turn of events.
I understand your concerns, he says at last to Xenia, and I agree with you.
I am glad to hear it, she says.
I will leave her with you, and I won't interfere with your visit. All I ask is that I may contact her on occasion.
Xenia gives a curt nod.
I have no problem with that.
He turns to Anna.
You will be safe here, and I will check on you regularly.
The trust that Anna places in Gleb is similar to the trust she places in a chair. She believes that he will be there to support her because he has been there for so long, doing that very thing. If the legs are wobbly, she tries not to think about it much because it's the only chair she has. Anna hasn't taken into account that Gleb will not be in Oyster Bay to help deflect any difficult questions. They cannot discuss the situation openly here in the driveway before the Leedses and the household staff. She thinks quickly, desperately, as she tries to read all the unspoken messages that flash across Gleb's face. There are so many words.